Welcome to the Optimistic Curmudgeon, where the best ideas win. I'm your host, Josh Herring. Today, my guest is Herr Professor Dr. Mark Bauerlein, or Mark, as he's agreed to be on the show today, a professor emeritus at Emory University, author of The Dumbest Generation and The Dumbest Generation Grows Up. He's also the regular host of the First Things podcast. I had the privilege of meeting Mark at the National Conservatism Conference in Miami last week, and I'm delighted to get to carry on that conversation today. Mark, welcome to the Optimistic Curmudgeon.
Thank you, thank you. You know, I made a mistake in the title of the second book, The Dumbest Generation Grows Up. I forgot the quotes. The Dumbest Generation Grows Up.
Oh. Well, that's very appropriate that they're adding scare quotes is now a seemingly a social necessity for plenty of folks. I went to Hillsdale College for undergrad, and we had a running joke. The campus newspaper, the Collegian, every year they would publish an article about the smartest class ever was coming to Hillsdale College, because every year the SAT, ACT scores would be higher, the average GPA required would go up. But it seems like your books are making an opposite claim, that in fact people are getting dumber over time. Is that accurate?
Well, Josh, remember, Hillsdale, you guys, you're not representative.
That's true.
You're atypical. The curriculum at Hillsdale makes you guys read and read serious, great books. And actually, you should feel very good about someone like me raising the numbers of the dumbest generation, because the silver lining is the worse your peers are, the better you look. Your teacher, your bosses are going to love you when they see so many of your peers strolling into the office at 9:30 in the morning, you know, with this in front of their eyes, and then wanting to talk to colleagues about what happened the night before, and the 50-year-olds in the office saying, "I can't wait until retirement." So, the numbers are very clear on intellectual habits, the intellectual habits generally of young people. Reading has been going down for decades. I mean, leisure reading, you know, voluntary reading in leisure time, not for work, not for school. In fact, on average, overall, homework assigned, reading homework assigned has gone up. That doesn't mean they do all the assignments, but the schools have tried to push more reading. And you know, with that big report in 1983, the No Child Left, or not No Child Left Behind, A Nation at Risk, which looked at plummeting standards and performance in the schools, the accountability movement really got going, and that led to all the testing, that led to No Child Left Behind Act, which was focused on reading and math, and then testing every 2 years students on reading and math. And we've got a lot of federal data that has built up over the decades by the US Department of Ed. And the trend lines are very poor. One, we have grade inflation. You know, I mean, in college, it's really gotten bad. When, you know, in 1960, the most common grade was a C in college classes. You know what I'm going to say now? The most common grade in college classes now is an A or A minus range. Now, kids didn't get smarter. And the swelling population, of course, suggests that the grades probably should have gone down. But the grade inflation, you know, set in, and that's all a long story about the decay of teacher and professor authority. The shift in respect for objective measures of learning, and the sentimentalization of the student, which really focused on not the student's work, but the student's life, the student's prospects, the student's career, especially as grad schools became more competitive. So those measures look like things are getting better. They're not. More young people getting college degrees. That sounds like it's the smart. I mean, when the Jumpers Generation came out in 2008, I gave a lot of lectures and interviews, and people said, no, the millennials are the smartest generation. More of them have college degrees than any other generation in history. And I says, well, that's for sure. But, you know, maybe you don't pay close attention to really what actually happens in college. But there was a book that came out called Academically Adrift about 10 years ago that compared test scores on a particular assessment of problem solving and critical thinking called the Collegiate Learning Assessment. From freshman year to senior year, very little gain students made. In some schools, you actually had negative learning. Their capacities for critical thinking and problem solving, their scores went down during those 4 years in college. So, sorry, don't buy the argument. Nope, college degree doesn't mean you're smarter, not anymore. Now, the reading scores, if we look just in the last 10 years, for instance, the SAT and ACT scores have fallen. You know, you've probably heard NAEP scores, what's been happening there. NAEP scores in reading have pretty much been flat for 12th graders overall in the last 50 years, roughly, in spite of the billions of dollars that have been poured into reading instruction. And the reason why it failed isn't so much the schools, the curriculum. Yes, there are problems there. But in fact, according to NAEP data, a greater determinant of reading achievement is not the amount of homework reading you do, but the amount of leisure reading that you do. And what happened from roughly the 80s up to today, the number of minutes young people spend with a book reading has plummeted. And we're not going to consider web surfing reading. We're not going to consider reading text messages reading. We're not going to consider Twitter reading. No, what we're talking about here is long form reading, focused attention, because that's the important reading. That actually is qualitatively different from skimming. Real reading. And I used to be a guy who thought, oh, it's got to be great, great books. It's got to be classics. No. Voluminous reading of genre fiction. You know, detective, adventure stories, romance novels. I don't care. You know, we should worry about those distinctions of quality of book once we have the demon of video games and social media and screens, you know, out of the picture. Then, you know, it's like Christians, you know, Protestants and Catholics arguing with one another. When you've got a secular society out to kill both of you, you know, let's just, you know, leave those quarrels aside.
Find a lot more common ground there for sure. I want to get a follow up on that. I don't know if you can see the shelf behind me, but this shelf is my sci-fi fantasy shelf. And over here is my hard literature shelf. Both, I think, are important, but I at least will anecdotally confirm what you're describing, because as a kid, I did not love serious books. I loved going to the library. I went through a Bruce Koval phase. He did like YA sci-fi. My parents were very much against Goosebumps and R.J. Snell. That was not okay. But I was just I would grab anything that had that sci-fi fantasy sticker at the library. And something happened when I was in my mid-20s. It was a combination of having to teach literature for the first time, but then also kind of finally getting frustrated with the repeated tropes inside my favorite genres. I sort of morphed into this slightly more discerning reader who might now want to pick up actual novels and not just a pulp bestseller. So I at least would agree with that. I think for me, that voluminous reading inside a genre was key. I could still read what was assigned in school, and I at least learned from my teachers and professors that those books were better in some difficult to describe measure of taste. but they weren't what I love. But as I've gotten older, the loves have pivoted in terms of I love the more complex reading now. I wonder, could you speak to maybe what are, I know you mentioned phones. Are there other things that you would look at as like, what have we replaced that leisure reading with? I mean, I assume children are the same. They still have curiosity. They still have desires, but instead those things are being directed elsewhere instead of leisure reading. Where do you see that going today?
I think it's going and going and going, and it's getting more sophisticated all the time, the video games and the social media. And what we need to remember is, and I wrote about this in the recent book, when Silicon Valley designed these tools and websites, they hired psychologists who are experts in addiction. You know, sometimes it's called persuasive design. That is, you design a website that is going to draw eyes and hold them there. And it's going to, you know, persuasion is bringing them in, getting them involved, and actually activating, you know, in the brain, some of those same centers that drugs activate. And the idea is to get them hooked, get them on the video game, get them on the website so that they don't want to leave and that they go into something called slow time. The term slow time. Slow time is when you get in front of a video game and you play it for 3 hours. And when you get up, you think you've been sitting there for 45 minutes. You know, time just flows and it seems like it's not that long. That's ideal because again, the longer the eyes are on these games, the more usage is made of them, the more money the Silicon Valley people make. And by the way, they don't let their own kids do these games. I mean, Steve Jobs famously kept screens away from his kids at home. They, the schools in Silicon Valley with the wealthier are ones like the Waldorf schools, which have no technology. And they know what the screens do to kids. They designed them that way. They keep their own kids away from them. And as I see it, it's just going to get more sophisticated. I mean, we've got more parents aware of the screen addiction problems. They're fighting against this. They're putting their kids in schools, you know, classical education schools, which tend to be lower tech than public schools. Now, politicians who public schools, they love technology. It looks like an easy way to support, to say, I believe in education. But the industry is multi-billion dollar industry that parents are struggling to resist. We have to understand that, you know, that this is doing Satan's work. All right, on planet Earth now. It's a demon. It's the enemy. And they have to take an adversarial position on this. And that forces them into, many liberal parents see this happening, and it pushes them into an uncomfortable position. Because a liberal is supposed to be in favor of progress. A liberal believes that things can get better with new innovation. They don't want to sound like they are reactionaries. They don't want to be resistant to the general trend of history. And they feel uncomfortable attacking the kids for their habits. No, live and let live. It's just a neutral tool. It's what people do with it. That's what really matters. The libertarian idea of we're all these super independent, rational choice-making creatures. Well, this actually runs against the main currents of liberal and leftist thought for quite a long time, which says that something like this that has been manufactured, invented, produced by corporations, global systems, marketed by advertisers who are out to manipulate people, to make money off of them, to say that this is a neutral tool Lies. Everything liberals believe about the social manipulation going on by big corporations. And it is strangely innocent or naive to think that we all have that capacity for being unaffected, uninfluenced. I'm back here. I can choose this or this or this. And what is the liberal position? I should have total freedom to do so. Well, you don't. You live in the world. You're being acted upon all the time by forces and influences. And what you need are counter forces and influences, such as the Sermon on the Mount, to help you recognize and fend off bad influences. And the kids can't do that on their own. They live in they're in a tidal wave of social media, of TikTok, of the videos, of stimulation. They soak up stupid movies. My goodness, I see 35-year-old men on airplanes watching Marvel superhero movies, and I'm embarrassed for them. What are you doing watching something for 13-year-olds? But this is the world that this is the consumer society, the media saturation, and the hyperstimulation that 13, 14, and 15-year-olds are living within. And they're not good intellectual habits. They're not producing a better vocabulary. They're not planting historical knowledge in their heads. They aren't acquiring the tools, the equipment, the great ideas, the great creations of beauty that would give them standards by which to judge all this present junk flowing into their heads. And see, I think the genre fiction that you read, that is great. All right. Reading, you know, crime stories, reading biographies of sports heroes and musicians or anything with that book. It's so important. It's silent. It takes uninterrupted linear concentration for 10, 20, 30 minutes at a time. This is actually a crucial habit for success later on in life. Now, what I argue in the current book is that millennials are now in their 30s, late 20s, 30s, up to 40 years old now. And they're in a sour mood. They're not happy. They don't particularly like their country. Less than 50% of them call themselves patriots. They don't have church. You know, they don't go to church very much. They don't have God, no transcendent orientation. They don't live in sort of reliable, familiar neighborhoods, right? They bounce around a lot. They don't have jobs where they see long-term planning taking place. They jump around a lot. And the economy has forced this on them in many ways. And they mistrust their fellow Americans. Social mistrust, as it's called, is high among millennials. They're not getting married and forming families at nearly the rate older generations did. We've actually got a serious birth problem now in the United States. One third of millennial men will not have been married by age 40. That's a huge amount. I wrote about this in the book. And that's a sign of sort of pessimism or groundlessness, the inability to see a positive future and build something. And they don't, here's the problem. They didn't get in those teenage years the equipment to handle adult difficulties. They don't have great stories of love, honor, betrayal, passion, loyalty, sacrifice in their heads. They don't have, as I said, any religious formation that would teach them how to handle disappointment. Right? They, disappointment. You know, right? Try reading the book of Job. How's that for disappointment? Try, go watch Death of a Salesman. Disappointment in middle age. Okay. These are the love, great love stories and rejection of Dido and Calypso and these stories. It would just give them a background of meaning, right? It would let them place the things that happen in their daily lives at age 30 into a context that would manage them a little better. They didn't get that, and so a lot of them go for the, and where do they go instead for meaning? Oh, racial justice and a climate and various utopian fantasies. And a utopian fantasy is a dangerous fantasy, as we know. But they don't know that. They haven't read George Orwell. You know, they're willing to cancel people for saying something politically incorrect. They don't know what happens when you start putting people in jail for speech, creating hate speech laws, destroying their lives. They don't know any sense of the history of those experiments. They don't appreciate the miracle of pluralism. It really is a miracle that we ever created a society where people can mingle and believe very different things about fundamental realities. That's pretty extraordinary that ever happened. That's one thing that, you know, 18th century liberalism, the Enlightenment gave us the capacity to mingle, to have a pluralistic society. Well, they don't, you know, that's what the First Amendment is about. Now, why should I have to listen to someone say something that I think is sexist? Shut up. You ought to be shut up. In fact, you ought to be removed from your job. So I'm going to sign a petition with 3,000 others to get you fired. But they feel very good about doing that. They're not embarrassed about that. They feel noble. This is virtue signaling with real consequences. And they feel the virtue. Again, because they didn't learn any lessons that they were supposed to learn in school and in the culture in their teenage worlds.
So what I'm hearing in a lot of all of this, I mean, I guess I've been making notes and all that. There's a lot I want to follow up on, but we don't have time to do that. But the heart of this seems to be that really education really does matter. And that in a very fundamental way, American culture has sort of gotten education wrong for a long time. And that getting education wrong for a long time, coinciding with massive leaps in technology and the ability to shape people's orientations and the loves of the heart and to distract them, has really robbed students of the necessary tools to withstand life's hardships and to find joy and happiness and meaning in the world. So instead, we have people looking for false sources of joy and happiness and meaning. Is that a fair?
That's very good. Yes. And think, you know, one of the things I did in the latest book is I was at Stanford and I go down into the archives and I asked the librarians to pull old catalogs from Stanford from the 1950s and 60s. And I looked at the general education requirements in 1959, you know, the year I was born. And the general education requirements at Stanford, and Stanford was on the quarter system, just like UCLA where I went. The quarter system is you got 3 terms a year. What Stanford required was a full year of Western civilization, a full year, 3 courses in Western civilization, a full year in English writing and literature, and part of the literature component was we're going to expose you to the greatest writing in the history of the English language.
So even if they're not using the term great books, it's still that sort of approach was what they were going with.
Josh, when the history department described, they handled the Western Civ sequence. The history department described it in triumphal terms, saying this is the legacy of a great civilization. These are great works, literature, art, music, great events, great leaders, and you are coming here to Stanford, first year. We are immersing you in a grand, magnificent inheritance. Now think about students coming, 19 years old, I'm coming to Stanford, and I am going to be handed the greatest geniuses, Michelangelo, Shakespeare, Virgil. This is, these are the masterpieces of human thought and creation. And I get it. And it had scope, right? It was a lineage, a heritage. It wasn't just random this and this and this. It was a big story. Capital B, capital S. And it flattered the young. You're coming into the world, and the world offers you a great story. Now, there's something, we know what happened.
I mean, there's also something profoundly democratic in that as well, in that you don't have to be American, African, British, French, Canadian, whatever, rich or poor, young or old. Any student coming into that classroom, this is your inheritance as a human being.
This is for you, right? Yeah. The world is for you. You know, Hannah Arendt wrote an important article about education in the 1950s, and I quoted from it, and her saying that so many of these educators now, progressivist educators, they don't like this idea of handing the young a world, putting them in the shadow of the greats. No. We're going to go for skills and problem solving. We want you to become critical thinkers, and we're not going to impose upon you the past. Well, Hannah Arendt said this idea was passed off as a form of liberation, letting the kids take ownership of their own learning. And Hannah Arendt said, what an awful thing to do to young people, to put them out in the world and say, we have nothing to push. We don't represent anything. We're almost like waiters, you know, handing you a menu. Would you like this? And I just bring it to you. Arendt said, you're on your, what we're saying is, we're not responsible. You're on your own. Well, that attitude certainly spread. And we added to that the political attack on Western civilization. So we destroyed it. And what do students coming to college now see? Not Hillsdale. You guys have held the line. What do they see when they go to college, when they look at the general education requirements? The things all colleges say, I must learn in order to become an educated, discerning, tasteful citizen. Nothing. Well, it's just a grab bag, you know, a diversity course requirement. Oh, what silliness. How uninspiring that is to the average 18-year-old. Diversity requirement? Wait a minute. No Hamlet? Really? No Macbeth? Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow? I don't get the great stuff. Well, maybe you do. If you want to do this instead, that's up to you. How dispiriting it is. And I see the young rushing toward, you know, Antifa or, you know, racial justice and so on, or hating Donald Trump. That's a reaction to the elders who failed them when they were teenagers. That is their anger at authorities who didn't act like good authorities when they were young. They feel we got no guidance. We were on our own. We had to compete to get into college, to compete for jobs, to compete for internships. And what did you represent to us? Nothing. You stand for nothing. You pass along nothing. You have no convictions. You don't even give us something meaningful against which to rebel. You people are wet noodles, spineless. My goodness, no wonder that black students march on the president's office angry at him, because you're so weak, right? I mean, you're not even looking at us as human beings here. You know, maybe you should get mad at us a little bit. At least we would feel like we're fully human beings when you do that. That I'm significant. I'm not just an image to you, an icon of some kind. You're not giving me any reality here. So this is, I think, what the colleges have done is it's a crisis of confidence of their own authority, and you've got a lot of timid, weak people now running colleges who are acting more like small-time politicians than as genuine educators.
I think you're reminding me of different philosophy professors along the way who I've heard make arguments about as human beings, we are meaning seeking and storytelling creatures. And so in the absence of a substantive story or real meaning to find, we replace that with either with a bad story or false meaning. And so it seems on the one hand, I just find it really interesting that even though the titles of your book sound like they indict the dumbest generation, they're not so much an indictment of that generation as they are the indictment of the previous perhaps two or three generations of curators of this tradition who should be sending something substantive to the next generation and instead really abdicated that responsibility. Well, Mark, do you see any hope for the present? Does your book end on a pessimistic note of despair? Or do you see places where that substantive encounter with meaning still survives or where we can turn to for better options than continuing the awful distraction that is TikTok? What are your thoughts as far as like something different for the future?
Josh, it's all over. There's no hope, Josh. It's done. I mean, look, we had, 2,300 years of the life of the mind, the disinterested pursuit of truth and beauty in some pockets. It survived. That's not too bad, is it? I mean, you know, the new dark age is upon us. It's a dark age in that it's so filled with so much noise and so much light, not illumination, just flickering lights off and on. I don't think there's really any going back into a bookish society. I would say that technology is going to advance farther and farther. We'll have artificial intelligence doing so much for us that we don't have to do for ourselves more and more. And the best one can do is realize, you know, parents here or young people realize that while the world is spinning down, you still can form a very good life for yourself and for your family in this regard. Know that if you read a lot of books, life is better for you. You can compete better. You are able to filter out nonsense, stupidity better. You are able to raise your children in a way that will lead to fewer symptoms in your children from the sick society that we inhabit. And people will recognize that. They'll see you as, again, an astute human being, knowledgeable and informed. You will speak in a way that doesn't insert a like into every sentence. you will find sources of joy in works of beauty and intelligence that are not accessible to other people because they haven't been exposed to them. You'll have a better life. You can do this. And that the world still appreciates the knowledge and talent that come with a reading life. The world does appreciate this. Offices need people who know how to write clear sentences, right? Science, medicine need good communicators. The media need people who are able to speak and write intelligently. They still do. The number of people who can do that is diminishing. You know, when we were at the conservative meeting in Miami, you heard Peter Thiel at the opening, a very interesting lecture. He always comes at issues in a sideways fashion that throws an interesting light on things. He talked about, we got to get more young people into STEM. Josh, I don't think we can get more young people into STEM.
I mean, I'm personally a little worried that we've been saying that now for at least 10 years that I've been paying attention. And I'm pretty sure that 20 years from now, we will have flooded STEM fields like we've currently flooded academia and the humanities fields with PhDs. Because 20 to 30 years ago, you actually could reasonably count on getting a PhD in history or literature or philosophy and finding a job doing that. Today, it took so long to change the societal messaging. I'm worried the same thing will happen with STEM.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced we need more STEM people. I think I agree with most of what you're saying, though I think I'm a bit more optimistic than you are, but I think we have a dearth of people who have values and actually understand that values fit inside of a general metaphysical framework that is connected to the transcendent. And without the transcendent, you don't really have a good reason to be a good person. We lack people who have those and who can articulate that, which has nothing to do with science, technology, engineering, or math, really.
Josh, you've got to be more optimistic than I am. I can afford to be. I'm old. So
oh, well, what I mean by that, as you were describing that, I was thinking of. I assume you know the novel A Canticle for Leibowitz.
You know. People keep telling me, you got to read this. I've never gotten around to reading this.
Okay. I don't know if you know Brad Berzer at Hillsdale College, but he sold me on A Canticle for Leibowitz, goodness, 15 years ago now. And that's one I've gone back to a few different times. It is a fabulous, it's a dystopian future tale of a collapsed society, but you start in somewhere like the year 2600 or so, with a new Dark Ages, and there's a monastery that has preserved the ancient knowledge. The ancient knowledge in this case is a diagram of a broken electrical circuit by a guy named Leibowitz. And the novel's made up of three short novellas that each are separated by a couple hundred years. And you get all the way through, and like this preservation of some knowledge eventually leads to the reconstruction of a whole way of life. And just as the world is about to destroy itself again in a nuclear holocaust, the last survivors of the Leibowitz monastery, by now they've canonized Saint Leibowitz the electrician, but they take off for a new planet to carry their civilization onward one step further. And I think that's, if we're I was listening for ways to disagree with your analysis. I don't have any, except that I do think there are, if there's room for hope, it's not necessarily hope for the entirety of an American culture per se, but it is hope for individuals, for families, for small communities that unite around sources of truth and decide to live together in consonance with that truth. I'm thinking particularly there of I think the classical renewal movement has led to thousands of schools that are made up of hundreds of families that are all trying to do just that. They're trying to recover those things that seemingly have been lost. And in as much as we can do that, and there's even there's even a, it's still a small handful, but there's still a smattering of new colleges, Thales College being the newest of them, up there with New College Franklin or New St. Andrews College in Idaho, that are trying to create new avenues for that substantive collegiate formation.
Yeah.
All of those are, they're small, but they're the, I don't know, maybe maybe to wax a little bit biblical, it's the still small voice rather than the whirling hurricane of a storm, where we might wish for a storm to be encompass all of society, but that's not what's happening. It's this, it's small, it's quiet. Maybe to do an even worse abuse to a New Testament metaphor, it's like a, if the kingdom of heaven is like a, is like yeast working its way throughout the whole loaf, maybe classical education is sort of the yeast of the old tradition working its way into modernity. What are your thoughts on all of that?
It's certainly exploding. You know, it's operating on a, on a, on a small base, but it is growing every single year. And it's a sign of more and more parents and students actually realizing this stuff over here, it's not good. It's not helping. It's not fulfilling my hunger. And so they are going into classical schools. They're expanding all the time. More are opening every month, it seems. A new classical school is opening. And that's a genuine sign of optimism. Yes. People pulling their kids out of the public schools and either homeschooling them or going to the classical schools. And the homeschooling generally leans more toward a classical orientation. And so we'll see. We'll see, Josh. I mean, you know, no matter what way the world is going, you still have to hold the line as best you can. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm pessimistic, but, you know, I'm writing things all the time. I'm visiting, speaking at classical schools to talk about, this is great. This is where it's happening. You know, the academic humanities in, you know, mainstream, the college campus, those are done. Those are over. And students, of course, are leaving those majors. They have voted with their feet against English and history and the languages. And that means that there's an opening for places like Hillsdale and Thomas Aquinas College and you know, the others you mentioned. Hillsdale has actually become, the applications to Hillsdale, Hillsdale Prof Good told me this the other day, they are shooting way up. Hillsdale is getting, I think it's under 20% selectivity rate. I think the selectivity is in about 15, 16%. Yeah. That's getting close to some of the lower Ivy League schools. So let's get more colleges like Hillsdale out there. Let's provide that alternative and see what the numbers are. I believe in numbers. You know, I think that when you got a sign of demand, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And the classical schools have got it. And they've got it because not any theory, not anything about students, it's about the content, right? Here, we're going to read, in this school, we're going to do a little Latin. We're going to teach Dante. Mm-hmm. We're going to listen to some Mozart. And we're going to study the Magna Carta. Mm-hmm. It's about the content, the material. Which is not what you're going to hear a lot about in ed schools.
I think it's very true. And that honestly, that is one of the biggest struggles we have in recruiting teachers. And there, we tend to have teachers of two categories, either folks come to Thales Academy, either deeply versed in a content area, but not having any of the skills that you'd pick up in an education program. Things like classroom management and how to write an email really clearly, how to structure a lesson, some basic psychology for different age ranges and so on. Or we have folks who come with all of those things, but they don't actually know anything about the content area. And it's not universally true. 9 times out of 10, we can work with people a lot more easily if they have the content already, if they know right. history or literature or their language or math right. or science or arts or music, whatever it is. We can work with them to help them with the, they'll have a first semester crash course education class, basically. And just through teaching and through their mentor, their department chair, their principal, all of these folks are helping them get those pieces underneath them. Man, we can, it is really hard to work with, to ask folks to basically pick up a second specialty at night by just reading 2 or 3 books a week to learn the material while right. they're working a full-time job. I would so much rather have folks who have gotten a really formative encounter in some substantive content area. And then they come teach, and we can help them with the, how do you do this thing called teaching? We can help with that part.
Yeah.
We can't be college and have them teach at the same time.
Right. I mean, how much of that, those teaching practicalities come through experience of teaching, right? You try things. Okay, this didn't work. I screwed that one up. All right, I'm going to adjust, you know, do it this time better. It's hard to theorize those habits in the classroom. So much of it is a judgment call. But yeah, some things like, how do you make an assignment, right? How do you, what are your grading standards? Things like that. That can be taught, right? Pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Relatively so. Well, Mark, I am kind of curious. What's the reception been like for your most recent book? I know writing sort of a closely tied together sequel separated by a decade. How has that gone over as far as receptivity? Have people liked your book? Has it gotten flamed? Has it been well reviewed? What's the reception been?
Lots of media, lots of discussion. Not as much attention as the first book got. And I think that's probably because we're in a different environment now. People are so absorbed in the political scene. And, you know, the Democrats, the Republicans, the lockdown, the midterm elections coming up. I mean, we really have entered, the country has entered into a condition of genuine political obsession. You know, how much national attention goes to the arts, to literature, to cultural matters? I mean, everything is so intensely political. The identity politics are just deranged in terms of what the news pays attention to, what social media focuses upon. You know, it wasn't that long ago that a novel could actually be a national event, in that it was something everyone needed to have an opinion on. Everyone in intellectual circles and cultural circles had to have an opinion on. When was the last time a novel struck a national chord? I've written a little bit about this. I would say it was, I mean, some people say it was Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities.
That's who I had in mind.
That was a huge cultural representation about America in a certain way. And everyone was talking about that. A few years later, we had Douglas Copeland's novel, Generation X. That certainly captured a mood for a generation. After that, you know, is there any novelist who is a major cultural force? In the way, say, in the 1960s, John Updike. John Updike was a real voice of a certain suburban middle-class world that was America, that represented an important part of America in sort of the national dialogue about things. Tom Wolfe was a representation of an important part of America. Anyone now?
I mean, there are figures like Toni Morrison or the lady I'm thinking of who wrote Gilead. I can't remember her name. Salman Rushdie was making splashes a couple weeks ago when he got shot. That's more about him as an author than it is. I mean, I'm pretty sure most of the people who talk about Salman Rushdie have not actually read the Satanic Verses. So I picked that one up years ago just because I wanted to be able to make reference to it intelligently. And that meant I had to have read it. And it was not nearly as divisive as I expected it to be. Like, I figured he would just like rake Islam over the coals. And it's not that. It's something different. Yeah. But I think you're right about there's not a, I was thinking about that in terms of, particularly in terms of, that we don't have that in music. I don't know of any huge culture straddling, current musicians, Hans Zimmer soundtracks, but those are so pop and, made into movie soundtracks that it's hard to differentiate pop culture and high culture. I don't know of anybody who kind of stands at that pinnacle spot.
Yeah, I mean who are the major voices of culture in America today? I mean, is it Mark Zuckerberg? You know, is it? I mean this is in a way this is the outcome of multiculturalism. Simply to break culture up so much, there is no national culture anymore. There are no national cultural voices or figures or traditions. No, they don't. And that was the goal. That was the goal of the left, to disintegrate American life. And they did it. They did it, Josh. I can't mention a book in a class at Emory University that every student has read. I could do that 25 years ago.
Sure.
Nearly everyone will have read Huck Finn. Mm-hmm. You know, the popular books were, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird and Huck Finn. Scarlet used to be Scarlet Letter. Everyone read that. But now there's nothing. There's nothing. And I think Toni Morrison actually is dimming her. I think her reputation is becoming less so. I think as time goes by, her works will appear a little more dated, but we'll see.
And this may just be my own lack of ability to read more contemporary stuff in that vein, but I tried to read Toni Morrison just because people I respect keep mentioning her, and I could not figure out what was going on. Cormac McCarthy is another contemporary who made a lot. He at least made more sense to me than Toni Morrison did.
Yeah. Yeah. The Road is that's a strong one.
Oh, I like The Road a lot. Mark, cool. What are you reading right now? I know you're always reading in part for your podcast, but I assume also for your own pleasure. What are you reading these days?
Well, for the podcast, it's focused on books. So I go through a lot of books for that. But you know, I will go back and read things like, you know, the crime novels of Georges Simenon, you know, the French profile of the French, the Paris inspector who was inspecting crimes, Maigret. So that kind of genre fiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll go through that. I will, you know, I'll read some of the old sort of hard-boiled detective stuff. By you know Ross McDonald or John D. McDonald, if those names mean anything to you. But I like to relax at night with a book that usually fiction that is sort of old-fashioned genre stuff.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, I know I listen to your show pretty regularly. I'd love if you could tell us a bit about your First Things podcast, how you got into it, and anything you want to say to plug your show.
Well, I came into First Things in 2014 as senior editor, sort of number two after Rusty Reno. And it was all editing. But, you know, the years go by, 2017, 2018, people are starting to do video and stuff on the website we're trying to build up. And I just started doing some of these podcasts, got rid of the video, it was a pain. And then I thought, you know, let's just make it about books. A lot of the big podcasts about politics and current affairs and people talking, I wanted to really uphold the book culture and highlighting books that aren't, you know, the big name ones, but are about issues important to First Things readers. So a lot about religion and culture and history, mm-hmm. and some politics, you know, Supreme Court cases affecting religious faith. So started doing it, and you know, it's pretty popular now. Sometimes we break 20,000 downloads for episodes. I'm happy with that. It also keeps you fresh. You know, you know, right? Mm-hmm. Having to interview someone, you yep. got to bone up on things, and you got to stay current. You learn new things. You have discussions. You listen to people talk. All I do on the podcast is ask some leading questions and get out of the way. Yep. You know, let the author. I say it's your show. You got a half an hour. It's your book. You know, let's talk about it. And that's my job.
Love it. I think one of my favorite parts about getting into podcasting has been it's a great way to meet really interesting people and just a way to keep up those connections over the years. Well, Mark, where can people find and follow your work online if they want to know more about what you do?
Well, you know, I do the stupid Twitter thing, you know, using it mostly not to argue or insult, but to pass on information, you know, things that have been published, the podcast, reminders about some historical facts when people say things that are erroneous, say not, no, that's not quite what happened, but trying to do it in a, you know, in an academic way. Let's put it that way. But you know, the book is on Amazon. It's got a nice discount rate of $21. And I actually invite parents to write to me if they have questions about their kids' education, the college application process, and I respond. I respond to people if they write to me, and my, you know, my First Things address is mbauerlein@firstthings.com. And I'm happy to talk to people about their children's educational future.
Oh, fantastic. And just in case any listeners have not figured this out by now, I'm also a fan of the First Things podcast, which you can find anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you search for First Things podcast, Mark's show will come up. He does really good interviews that are exactly as he described. I think your show is one of my influences, at least, but also alongside, I don't know if you know the Christian Humanist podcast guys. They're a trio of one guy is still an English professor. The other two have since moved from the professorship down to the K-12 world. But they all started conversing with each other over a podcast to stay in touch. And the conversationality of your show and of their show both helped me with thinking through what I wanted podcasting to look like.
Very good.
If you enjoyed this at all, do be sure to follow Mark's show as well. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been great.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Josh, and we'll be in touch.
All right. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today for another episode of The Optimistic Curmudgeon. My guest this episode has been Dr. Mark Bauerlein, professor emeritus at Emory University, author of The Dumbest Generation and The Dumbest Generation Grows Up. He's also the regular host of the First Things podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a 5-star review and share it with your friends. Until next time, seek the good, discover the true, and love the beautiful. You've been listening to another episode of The Optimistic Curmudgeon, where the best ideas win. I'm your host, Josh Herring. The Optimistic Curmudgeon is a project of Thales Press. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star review and share it with your friends. You can find us on 3 major social media platforms. Search for The Optimistic Curmudgeon on Facebook and LinkedIn, and find us on Twitter at the handle @TheOptimisticC3. This episode was edited and produced by Madison Kay, audio engineer for The Optimistic Curmudgeon. Until next time, seek the good, pursue the true, and love the beautiful.